Rabbi Yonah brings down the Shari Tshuva, where the author of Nothing said that makes a connection between the words of Chazal, the Mishnah, that Kol Shechokhmato Merubah Mima'asav Ein Chokhmato Mekayemet, as opposed to Kol Shema'asav Merubah Mechokhmato Chokhmato Mekayemet. The Avister of Nosan adds on as a source for the idea that Kol She Ma'asav Merubah Mechokhmato Chokhmato Mekayemet. What is the source for the fact that when someone's ma'asim, the actions of Torah and mitzvot are concrete and there, even greater than the chokhma of Torah that he has acquired, that will be the greatest guarantee of preservation of his chokhma. Chokhmato mitkayemet. It says the opposite of Nathan, shenemar nase v'nishma. Nase v'nishma is an acceptance, a asiya, acceptance of action, even before the shmiyah, before the understanding, nase v'nishma. This is a guarantee. When a person is on the madrega, explains Rabbeinu Yonah, where nase v'nishma, his commitment is there, then bevadai bevadai, chokhmato mitkayemet, his chokhma of Torah, his chokhma of understanding the world, will be guaranteed to be preserved, will remain, and will always be there, will be a very real chokhma. We're privileged to have with us today a Talmud Chacham, a Chacham who is b'chinat chokhmato mitkayemet, who besides the tremendous insights and advancement, sophistication of chokhma, of understanding of Yahadut, has enabled so many of us and those who have heard his lectures and read his books also to follow through and have this anchored in an asiyah, going ahead and taking that chokhmah and translating it into action, a concrete action which allows our chokhmah afterwards to be mitkayem. We're very honored to have Rabbi Cardozo, a world-renowned lecturer, author, as I said, many of us have seen his books and now have the opportunity to hear Rabbi Cardozo in Yeshiva Shalvim. Thank you very much for joining us today. We're very honored and we hope that we'll be able to take from your Dvei Chachma, apply it to our lives to make our understanding of Torah that much deeper and that much more concrete and mitkayim.
Okay, here's to everybody. First of all, my thanks to Robert Wexman for inviting me and being able to share with you today some mashalot in Yahadut, in our Masoret. You will have to get used to my English. I'm originally from Holland, and that explains my accent, but it takes you a few minutes and you will be with it. It happens to be that tonight is the Yahrzeit, the Yom HaZikaron of my father, so I obviously dedicate at the same time this Shi'ur to him, Rabbi Yaakov ben Naftali, and I hope that in that way his neshama will also make an aliyah. I'm going to take you to a world which you're perhaps not so used to. And I need to ask you, I know that it's not fair perhaps already in the evening, to concentrate, because what I'm going to say is a little complicated, but if people have learned the Marat, then they should know how to deal with that. There was, in several years ago, in Europe, in Paris, there was a very famous non-Jewish philosopher who indeed became a universal personality of tremendous greatness and a man of tremendous stature in the world of secular machshava, secular thought, who was called, French name, by the name of Jean-Paul Sartre. Sartre was a very interesting man. He's one of the great French philosophers in the 20th century. And he belongs to the school which they call in the world of philosophy existentialism. I shall not go in telling you what this is all about, but it's a particular way of thinking. In 1946, the year after the Shoah came to an end, this Gentile, this non-Jew, wrote a book, a booklet, about anti-Semitism. He was a very big Ohed Israel. He was a man who was close to the Jewish community, he was not religious himself. But it bothered him why there was something called anti-Semitism. And he tried to understand and to analyze why do people become anti-Semitic? What makes a Gentile into an anti-Semitic personality? And this is something which, badly enough, we experience at this very moment as well throughout the Jewish community, anywhere in the world, anti-Semitism. And it's perhaps important for us for a moment just to take notice of what he writes. And then we'll speak a little bit more about it and see what we have to say about it from the perspective of Chazal. This little booklet, by the way, which is translated in loads of different languages, also in Hebrew, is called in English Antisemitism and the Jew. And it is basically an attack on the anti-Semitic world. And one of the things which this Sartre, this philosopher, says is this: people become anti-Semitic because they are what he calls inauthentic. What does he mean by that? There are people who are authentic, there are people who are inauthentic. People who are inauthentic are people who can't really live with themselves. They are people who are actually hating themselves. And because they failed in life, because it didn't work out for them, or because they hated themselves, they look for somebody to put the guilt on. To say, this person it is, or this people it is, who created my problems. That is a person who is not able to look in the mirror, who can't see himself, doesn't want to hear about his mistakes, his failures, his limitations. And you always look for somebody and to accuse that person of his failures. That's an inauthentic person, says Sartre. An authentic person is a person who can look in the mirror, who won't look for somebody else, but who will take himself for what he is, the good side, the bad side, and lives with it. He's not frustrated about himself. But the person who's inauthentic is the frustrated person who's really frustrated with himself. That's inauthenticity. Says this philosopher, Sartre, that that is the basis and the foundation of anti-Semitism. The anti-Semitic person is a person who is inauthentic, he can't live with himself, he hates himself, and he projects his hate on somebody else because he doesn't want to hear that he really hates himself. That makes him anti-Semitic. And for some reason, he will always look, and we understand also why, for a minority, for people who can't defend themselves, because these people you can easily attack. People who can't defend themselves, you can do anything with them. And the Jew, in the last 2,000 years, not having his own homeland, not being able to stand up very often for him, and anyway discriminated all the time and looked down to, he is the ideal victim of this, according to Sartre. He's the person you can put all the guilt on. He can't defend himself in any way. He's a minority in Europe and many other places in the world. And therefore, over the many years, and according to Sartre, people, more and more anti-Semitic people, or people who hated themselves, became anti-Semitic people purely because that was their way out. And that way they were able to hate others, and they wouldn't have to pay the price for it because these people were not able to do anything back to them. And that is created out of what he calls, as I said, inauthenticity. Okay. But then in the same booklet, and you have to listen well, Sartre then asks one other question. What makes a Jew authentic? And when is a Jew inauthentic? How does that work? And there, first of all, he starts off like this, and we are able to agree with that. He says like this, I quote you. For a Jew to be authentic, he writes, is for the Jew to live to full his condition as a Jew. If the Jew lives like a Jew lives, or should live, then he's authentic, and that's what Jews should do. Which seems to sound hard. Because what it means is, what we also agree with, if you are proud about being Jewish, and you decide yourself who you are, and you're not allowing other people to decide who you are, and you're able to look yourself in the mirror and say, I'm a Jew and I'm proud of it, that's indeed authenticity. But hear what this Sartre does. Sartre gives a totally different interpretation to this. Very strange, very disturbing. He says, I tell you what I mean when I say that Jews should be authentic. I don't mean by that what you and I mean by that. He means something else, and I quote you again. He says, the problem with Jews are, and I quote, hear this, Jews have neither community, they lack community, they have a lack of a community of belief, they do not have a fatherland, and they do not have any history. The Jews have no history, they have no community, they don't have a religion, they don't have anything of that. Very strange. No doubt Sartre knew, was close to the Jewish people, that they do have a religion. True, they're not living in their fatherland, but they're thinking all the time about it, Eretz Israel. And he definitely knows that if any nation in the world has got history, more than anybody else, it are the Jews. So what is he saying? That Jews have no history. They have no beliefs, they have no community. Very strange. But before I will try to respond to this, he continues. He says, what is it that brings Jews together? What is the common element which holds Jews together and somehow creates some kind of community after all? Well, I read you again from what he writes. I quote, the soul tie, the binding element between the Jews, which binds them, is the hostility and the disdain of the societies which surround them. Jews, in according to Sartre, are a group, and they stay together. They are bound together, you know why? By the sin'ah, by the hate of others. As long as that sin'ah, that hate is around, Jews will hold to themselves. Jews will connect to each other, because there is one thing which they have in common. Nearly everybody else hates them. Says Sartre, that's the reason why Jews were able to make it for the last 4,000 years. Since they were always hated, if it was in the days of the Roman Empire, if it was in the days of the Greeks, the Persians, we all know about it, they were always a minority group which was hated by others, and therefore they had to hold together. And because of that reason, they were able to survive everybody else. But they don't have normal history. They don't have community because of other reasons. This is the only thing what binds them. Now, if indeed the Jew does so, if he agrees and he admits this, that this is what makes him into a Jew and holds them together, then he is authentic. And the moment that he does not want to admit this, he becomes inauthentic. And if you think for a moment with me, you understand that here, Sartre, and I'm not the first one to write this or to say this, contradicts himself. Because remember what he said before? Authenticity is when you decide yourself who you are and you take yourself the way you are. Nobody else is going to tell you who you are. You are the one. And Sartre says that's true about everyone. But when it comes to the Jews, their authenticity is only built on one principle. That others hate them, in other words, others look down on them. It is not the Jew himself who decides who he is, but it is the Gentile anti-Semitic world which decides who he is, and only then he's authentic. Now that's a paradox. Because if you first say that somebody is only authentic when he himself decides who he is, then that should apply to the Jew as well. No, says Sartre, in the case of the Jew is different. There, the non-Jewish or often the anti-Semitic world actually is the one which creates the Jewish community. It builds it. And how does it build it? By creating hate towards the Jews. And now he makes an unbelievable move. Very disturbing. He says, what we have to look for in this world is a world where all people are authentic. That is, when people stop making other people guilty of why they are the way they are, and no longer accusing other people, but being able to look in the mirror and see yourself for who you are, if all human beings would do that, then everybody would be authentic. And that's the ideal world. And therefore he says, let's try to build that world. And that will make an end to anti-Semitism, because the anti-Semitic person is only there because he's inauthentic. But you know what he actually says? If you think a little closer, he says the following. If anti-Semitism is the very foundation why Jews are Jews, and why they were able to hold out for the last 4,000 years, and you are now claiming that the world without anti-Semitism is obviously a better world, and you say that anti-Semitism is built on the fact that it is inauthentic and you want everybody to be authentic, then you know what he's saying? He's saying the following. The ideal world is a world without Jews. Because Jews only exist because others hate them. So the moment they stop hating them, Jews stop to be Jews. And that's the ideal world. And he writes this because he loves the Jews, no doubt. He wants his anti-Semitism to stop. But he does not realize, at least not in the booklet, that by saying this, he in fact is also arguing that the world would be a much better place without Jews. And then he comes very close to somebody else in Machshavah, and that was Hitler. Because Hitler was the same man who said the same thing. The world without Jews is a better place. And that's the reason why he created the Holocaust. And Sartre, for exactly the first reasons, because he really wants and he likes the Jews and he loves them, he really at the same time wants to make them to disappear, because he knows, and according to him at least, Jews only exist because others hate them. Stop the hate and you make an end to the Jewish people. That's what he says. Now, I'm not going to argue tonight with him if this is true, yes or no. I obviously disagree. But I want you for a moment, and again I have to ask you to concentrate, to think with me somewhere else. And that is this. You will. The question that you should ask today is the following. We as Jews, how many of us, how many of our fellow Jews, are, without knowing that, actually buying into this definition? that we are Jews really only because of one reason, because others don't like us. And that pulls us together, that binds us together. It's the most important question to ask. You and I, no doubt we are proud about being Jewish, but we are a minority in many ways. We are not the typical case. We have to ask the question, if Jews indeed would somehow agree with this statement that we are still around today only because nobody accepted us, so we lived on our own, we built our own ghettos, we lived in our own Jewish world, because nobody else was able to take us. And that's the reason why we survived. That's a most important question, you'll see in a moment why. Is it true that anti-Semitism really is the one thing which kept the Jews alive? And I can tell you, if you look around in many studies done by sociologists today, philosophers, historians, you will see that many would buy into this very argument. We are really only around still because the others did not accept us. So we were not able to assimilate. We were not able to do what we perhaps would have liked to do, to become part of the larger world. Let's go back a little bit in history. A few hundred years ago, less than that, 150 years ago, if you would ask any Jew, your great-grandparents, my great-grandparents, tell me something. What does it mean to you to be Jewish? Then he will give you an elaborate answer, and that answer will always reflect his pride. There's something special about the Jew. We are the chosen people, the Amani Khar. We have a special task in this world. We have special mitzvot in this world. We always took pride in that. But we know quite well that since, actually it starts already in the 17th century, I will not go into this now, but especially more or less in the last 100 years, more and more people are saying, well, you know, the religious meaning of to be Jewish is no longer the one which we accept. It's not the halakha. Not the mitzvot. We are looking for other ways by which we can give ourselves a definition. But you know, we don't want to go into this religious dimension because we feel it's outdated. It's over. Since the days that the Jew emancipated, as we call it, the emancipation of the Jews only 200 years ago, we feel that now we are part of a larger world, we are more accepted, at least to a certain extent. We have to understand and restate what is the definition of a Jew. It's no longer you're Jewish because you belong to a mission called the Amami Khar, not because you happen to be a child of a Jewish mother or because you converted. We are looking for a more secular definition of what it means to be Jewish. Perhaps you remember in the days of the first Prime Minister of Israel, Ben Gurion. He was actually the one who very much pushed this concept. He once wrote a letter to all the famous rabbis, secular thinkers in the Jewish community. This is in the 1960s. And he asked one question over there, what does it mean to you to be Jewish? Because he was looking for a different definition than we have had up till this moment, at least the halachic definition. And he got loads of answers. No time to go into this now, but definitely many of them said, we need a different definition. And now I tell you something very interesting. Once people stopped using the halachic religious definition, you will look back into history of the last 100, 200 years, and you will see that the whole issue became totally confused. Since that moment, everybody's merely got his own interpretation about what it means and why people are called to be Jewish. And we have lost a certain unity because of that reason, and we're shooting all sort of different directions. I'm going to give you one example of it. The chief rabbi of England, Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, wrote a very beautiful booklet, which, by the way, if you ever are able to read it, do so, it's beautiful. It's a booklet which he wrote when his children got married, and he wanted to give them some kind of a statement of what he believes in, that he hopes that they will also take over. And his book is called, today it has a different name than it used to be in the past, When I bought it, it was called Radical Then, Radical Now. I think it is now called A Letter in the Scroll. Very marvelous booklet where he lays out his understanding of what it means to be Jewish. Beautiful, beautiful thing. Anyway, at the beginning, he tells the story how that became to Geshem. He says there was, when he was not yet the chief rabbi, a group of young Jewish university students came to him. I think Cambridge, Oxford, one of these places. And they said to him, listen, we have to write a paper about something Jewish, but we don't know about what. Have you got a suggestion? So he said, yes, I have a suggestion for you. You know what you do? Write a letter to some very famous English, British Jews, and ask them one question. What does it mean to you to be Jewish? And if you send this to 70, 80 people, you get a lot of material to work with, and you can write very few, very nice papers about this. Okay, so they sent the letters. And how interesting. Only 4 people responded. And I'll read you one of them. One professor, a Jewish professor, writes the following. He says, I will tell you what it means to be Jewish for me. And you know how I do that? I will actually quote an Israeli student I once had, who I asked that question. What does it mean to you to be Jewish? And here is his statement, literally, in English. I have it in front of me here. Here it is. This young man said like this. Yahadut, Judaism, here it is a hereditary disease. You can get it, or better, you get it from your parents, and you pass it on to your children. It's an illness. It's a machala. You get it from your parents, and you pass it on to your children. And why do I call it an illness? My answer is because not a small number of people have died from it. Quite a few Jews died because they were Jews. I see it as a machala. I see it as a hereditary disease. That's my definition. And the professor says, I agree with you. I am not proud about it. I have to live with it. It's a machala. What can I do? And I can tell you, many studies have been made about that. Baruch Hashem, you and I are not part of this. But the truth about it is that there are loads of young people, and some of them are also in this country, who would also buy into this statement. You know why we are Jews? Because others hate us. That's what kept us going. It's a hereditary disease. And it was somewhere we hope one day to get rid of it. And by saying these statements, and I hope you realize that, they get very close, if not identical, to what I just said in the name of Sartre. We are hated, and that keeps us together. Anti-Semitism is the most important foundation for Jewish survival. Now that's very disturbing. How can it be that people came to that kind of a conclusion, you ask yourself? How is it possible that people can think in these terms? That is what it means to be Jewish, it's a machala, it's a disease. But I tell you why this comes about. Once there is no longer the deeper meaning of being Jewish in the religious sense of the word, once there is a completely misunderstanding or disconnection with halacha, and Jews are looking for other definitions, but it can't be religious anymore. The problem which sociologists have already shown for a long time is this, that because of that very reason, nobody is able to come up with a positive statement about being Jewish. And everything becomes now a matter of negation. We are Jews because something went wrong, not because something went right. And you know how we know about this? Well, one of the most important reflections of that, symptoms of that, is the following. I don't know if most of you are, I suppose you're from America. You know quite well that American Jews, but by the way, this happens in Europe as well, one of the things which more and more stands out in that community, I'm not speaking about the religious community, I'm speaking about the general American Jewish community. What is it that they are extremely busy with? One of the things which keeps them going, and we see it everywhere around, is indeed the Holocaust, the Shoah. I don't know if you know, but the amount of museums built in America to memorize and to remember the Holocaust is enormous. And it's getting more and more. We're building them here, we're building them there, in nearly many different places where there are Jewish communities, you have today memorials. Memorials for the Holocaust. I'm not saying that that is all what they do, but what sociologists have shown us, and again, no time to go into this now or even to prove that, is that somehow it went out of proportion. It became the new identity of many Jews. It is our communal experience of what went wrong in the 1940s and 1950s, 1945 till 1945. It is that what we ourselves are perhaps more part of it, but our parents were part of it, our grandparents were part of it, that became a major issue of Jewish identity to a large percentage of the American Jewish world. By the way, this is true in Europe as well, a little different, but very similar to that. Why is that? One of the reasons is, and again, I'm not the first one to say this, is because once you lose the ultimate or original meaning of being Jewish, and you're looking for something else, it is not so easy to find something what really will fit into this, which will give us an understanding in a positive light, also we'll see in a moment more about this, of what it means to be Jewish. So what happened over here is the Holocaust became a symbol of suffering, and it is the symbol of suffering which binds Jews together in many different places. The problem with that is, obviously, how can you build a future on such a philosophy? I can, by the way, tell you for sure, no time to go into details, not only the Holocaust memorials are many of them, and by the way, I'm the last one to object against them, they're important. But if you're going to say that this is what makes us Jewish, our suffering as a nation, then there are problems. Another example of that given by sociologists is that the Holocaust programs dominate the Jewish university world today. Many campuses where most Jews today, young people, are busy with is the study of the Holocaust. Literature, exactly the same. The amount of books which are published about the Holocaust is out of proportion to any other particular topic which is of Jewish interest. It became an identity. It unites, as somebody once wrote, an otherwise divided community. Where we are still able to agree with all of us on is that we together suffer. The moment we start to speak about something which relates to what it means in a positive sense, what it means to be Jewish, we're already going to have many differences within it, and we are not sure if it really exists. Somebody once said like this, writing about this problem. The danger in this philosophy is the following. Put it in one sentence. You cannot build Jewish future on the ashes of Auschwitz. If you think that Auschwitz is the one, any of these camps where 6 million people died, if that can give us the impetus to continue to be Jewish, then you're badly mistaken. Because out of negation, you are never able to build something in a positive sense. And what is happening, and we see loads of examples for that in the general world, and that goes back to the statement I just read about this young man who says it is a machala, it is a hereditary disease to be Jewish, is that we ultimately see that people therefore start even to hate being Jewish, because if it just means one thing, that is a community which is suffering, why should I want to become part of that? Why should I want to be part of a world which is basically built on its identity as a people who are constantly in pain? Nobody can build a future on that. But subconsciously, we have been doing this for a long time, and that's, by the way, one of the main reasons why it is that today many young people are walking out on it. If you tell me that that is what it means to be Jewish, then I don't want to be Jewish. Somewhere, obviously, it is an escape. Running away from the other side of what it means to be Jewish and not perhaps wanting to discover that and not to see this. Obviously, I don't have to tell you. The Jewish world survives not because of Auschwitz, but despite of Auschwitz. Because we were able to do something, and we'll see in a moment what that is, by which we were able to say, you know, whatever happened to us in Auschwitz, that will not determine what we are going to be and whom we are. But the amount of people have been thinking about it carefully and have really worked this out are a minority. Now you may say to me, Rabbi Kadosh, it's all very nice, but it's not true. At least not completely true. You know why? Because is there not something else which also created Jewish identity of a totally different nature? And what is that? Well, you experience it this very moment. Medinat Yisrael, the state of Israel. If there's anything positive, if anything great happened in the last 2,000 years in Jewish history, it is the building in 1948 of the Jewish state. And I remember very clearly that at the time when the state was established, I was still a kid at the time, I remember an enormous pride indeed to be part of this undertaking, to build a state after 2,000 years, to come home again after what happened to us in the Holocaust 3 years later, 1948, Ben-Gurion saying we have a state and every Jew is able to come home. That was an unbelievable thing. And what was more important, I remember I come from a Zionist background. I remember that at home we used to speak about in the following terms. The Shoah symbolizes diaspora suffering. Israel, on the other side, is a new proud identity. This is the marvelous thing. We have something really to be proud about. Let's forget about the Holocaust, or at least not make that our main center of thought and of identity. I also remember something else, perhaps you don't, because you're a little younger, but I remember very clearly that it was always told to us that Israel was the solution to anti-Semitism. If we would go home and we would be here in this place, we would, here's a very heavy word, we would normalize ourselves. We were abnormal in diaspora, a nation without a home country, without a country, without an army, without money. That's an abnormal situation. And indeed, for the last 2,000 years, we lived in abnormal circumstances, where indeed most of the world hated us, at least in the Western Europe, European countries. And the moment we would go home, build our own country, build our own state, have our own army, everything would fall in place, and I remember very clearly, we were promised by our parents and our teachers that once we would do this and establish this, the world would start to accept us. The world would say, ah, now the Jews are like us. They have their own nation, they can do what they want, they have their own army, they have their own economy, they have their own universities, all what they do, now they are one of us. But as long as this nation is living in this abnormal situation of a nation within a nation, like we did most of the time, they're living as a nation, the Jewish people between other nations, that's so abnormal that because of that reason the world didn't like us. But once we would become a nation like everybody else, everything would be fine. You probably don't remember that because you are too young from that, but this was one of the main reasons why we built the State of Israel. It would make an end to anti-Semitism. I don't have to tell you that now, in the very days in which we live, we hear exactly the reverse, even by our own people. Because now we are going to hear some people, and obviously we don't agree, we are being told now today that the reason why at this very moment there is so much anti-Semitism in the world is because there is a Jewish state. That very state which originally was planned and built that it would do away with anti-Semitism is now, in according to these views, the very root of all anti-Semitism. And now we are hearing, even Jews are sometimes saying that, you know what, we made a big mistake by creating the state of Israel, because that only created more hate, and if we would have stayed in Europe and all the other places, they would have easily accepted us. So what did we do? in the last years. We have turned around 180 degrees. Now the argument is exactly the reverse of why we started this place in the first, sense of the word, and we suddenly came up with a totally different philosophy which we have never heard about a long time ago. That's what you and I experience at this moment, although many people are not aware of it. So what is the state? Is the state a solution to anti-Semitism? Or is it the very creation of anti-Semitism? The foundation of creating even more anti-Semitism? What it proves is this, and again, no time to go into very great details, and it comes to a moment how Chazal looked to this. But what we have to realize is the following. No state in the world, not even the Jewish state, of which we are all proud. By the way, I told you, I served in the Israeli army, and I'm very proud of that also. But you have to remember one thing. The state of Israel is not able to build Jewish identity either. It is not the Holocaust who can do that, neither the state can. Because that's not the function of a state. No state is able to create identity. A state and an army, including our own army, Tzahal, is there to somehow secure us and to defend our identity. Not to create it. Not to make it. Because that's never in history the case with any kind of state or any kind of a community. What it is a means to something. It's never an end in itself. The state is there to allow people to be whom they are. But what they are is not to be indeed determined by the state, but is already presupposed by the state. We are Jews. Now we need a place where we can really be Jewish. For that we need Tzahal, we need the army, we need whatever it is. And therefore, at that very moment, the state becomes extremely important to us because it will guarantee us that we continue, are able to continue to be Jews. But if we are going to say, and some of us have said it in the past, that the new Jewish identity is to be, for example, an Israeli soldier, or for that reason is determined by the state or the government what it means to be Jewish, then we are misreading from every point of view, and not only from a religious point of view, of what a state is able to do, what an army is able to do, and what it should not be doing. That's not its function. So the Holocaust is not going to help us out over there, because it's negation, and even the Jewish state hasn't got the strength as such to create that Jewish identity, because it cannot do more than just defend that identity, to allow for its existence. I always say, and this perhaps may be a very critical remark, but I want you to think about it. I think one of the big mistakes we made is that we started to call ourselves Israelis. The moment we started to call ourselves Israelis instead of being Jews, we confused the whole situation. Because really what it does is, and it often has functioned like that, and it's unpleasant to admit that, but looking back it is very clear that it happened, is that it became a way out. I don't want to be Jewish. But I do want to be an Israeli. And now we see again that indeed people who think like that or often leave us and they go and live somewhere else, or again they don't have enough Jewish identity to stay in this country because this country is sort of 55-60 years old, and it's definitely not enough for a mere person to say only because the state exists I happen to live here as an Israeli. And I forget about 3,000-4,000 years of Jewish history beforehand, which gave the push to have this particular state. Very problematic. It's something we definitely have to think about as far as the future. So let's look into identity. And let's understand a little bit what identity means, and for that I'm going to take you to last week's parasha. Parashat Bishalach. And take note. The story, as we read it last week in Parashat HaShavua, tells us that Am Yisrael comes close to the Red Sea, to the Yam Suf. And we know that at the moment when they stood there, the Egyptian army was behind them because they wanted, as you know, Pharaoh wants to take the Jews back home again. Why does he, by the way, want the Jews home again? The reason is because once the Jews have left, or even Midrashim who indicate that, Pharaoh saw that his economy was falling apart. He needed the Jewish brain, and the brain was gone. And he realizes that he can't continue to run this state without the Jews. The Jews became already part of the state, and therefore he wants them back. By the way, I remember very clearly Winston Churchill, the Prime Minister of England, many years ago in the days of the Holocaust, was once asked, are you in favor of the Jewish state or are you against it? So he said, I'm a Zionist, but I'm not sure I will let the British Jews go. So they said, why? He says, because I'm afraid that if the British Jews go, the British economy will fall apart. I never want to keep them here. We have heard this many times. Anyway, Pharaoh is on his way with his army to bring the Jews back, and they're standing at the very edge of the Yam Sea. Just a Torah like this. You will. Vayibash Morit HaBokir. And it was early in the morning. Vayashkev Hashem il Machaneh Mitzrayim. And Hashem looked down on the Machaneh, on the camp of Mitzrayim. Ba'amud Eish, Ba'anom, with the pillar of fire and with the cloud of glory. And then it says like this, very interesting. Vayaham it Machaneh Mitzrayim. Difficult to translate in English, but it means something like this. And he, that means HaKadosh Baruch Hu, he confused the camp of the Egyptians. He did something to them psychologically, by which they got confused and therefore they couldn't do the job and were not able to really fall on top of the Jews and turn them home again. Bring them home again, what they called home. Says Rashi, what is the word by Yaham mean? Rashi tries to understand what is the pshat in the word by Yaham. Says Rashi, Irvevan, which means he mixed them up. And then he says, Benatal Sikniyot Shilahem. And he took their Siknon away. Now you know the modern word Ivrit, Siknon means style. Well, yeah, Siknon means in art, in fashion. Siknon means many different things. But it always means a certain way of doing things, particular way of doing things. So he says, Rashi says, what is it and how did Hashem create confusion in the Egyptian camp? The answer is, he confused them by interfering in their identity. They were no longer sure who they were. And I'll tell you what I mean. Very interesting. The Gemara in Sanhedrin is Peitet Amud Al. If you have an opportunity, have a look there. It's a marvelous Gemara. The Gemara asked the following question. It asked, how do you know that the Navi is a Navi shaker? How do you identify a false prophet? Not so easy. Somebody comes and he says, I am speaking in the name of Hashem. This is what he told me. How do I know he's telling the truth? We know there's a concept of a Navi shaker. He's chayav mita, he's even liable of death penalty. So you know what the Gemara says? One of the ways to know if somebody, a prophet, is false or not, is an Abi Sheker or an Abi Emet, is the following. Here it is. Siknon Echad Ola Lekama Nevi'im. When HaKadosh Baruch Hu, now you have to listen carefully, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu brings his Nevu'ah to the Nabi, he speaks, Hashem, God, speaks in his own style, in his own way. HaKadosh Baruch Hu has his own way of doing things. He has his own Siknon. So when he speaks to the Nevi'im, he speaks to them in exactly the same way. In the same style. But then continues the Gemara, Ve'ein shnei Nevi'im mitnavdim besiknon achat. But when it comes to the Navi, afterwards, to bring what he just heard from Hashem to the Jewish people, he has to pass the information on. It comes to him from Hashem, and then he has to give it over to the others. Each one of them, says the Gemara, will have his own Siknon. No two Nevi'im, no two prophets, will ever have the same Siknon. But everybody's different. Everybody's made different. Everybody's got different psychology. And even the Navi, when he's busy bringing the words of Hashem towards Am Yisrael, he has to filter this through his own personality, and because it is going through his own personality, he therefore will give it a specific style which belongs to his own personality, to his own issue. So what happens? Says Rashi over there. But remember one thing. Therefore, we know who is an Abi Shaker. You know how? If two Nevi'im will come to Am Yisrael, who just heard the Nevu'ah from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and they will give it over in exactly the same way, in the same siknon, then it means that one of them is false. Why? Because it can never be that two people will have the same siknon. That two people will have exactly the same style, that's artificial. Everybody is a human being on his own. Everybody is a creation on his own. So the moment that somebody starts to say exactly the same way of bringing over the nevoah, then it means they make up a deal. It means that one is trying to basically to copy the other one. So one is not telling the truth. And the moment when one of them is not telling the truth, he's an abishaker. That's the way how we identify. How interesting. Yes, even when it comes to a Navi, every Navi is different. And even when he brings the Nevoah to man, to human beings, to Am Yisrael, he will do it in his own style. And if therefore two have exactly the same style, one is false. That's the and one of the great Baalei Machshava in the last century, I'm sure you've heard about him, was, they call him in the Yeshiva world, Rabbi Yerucham from Mir. Mir Mashkiach. One of the finest people we have had in the last century. And he speaks about this. I read you in Hebrew or translated in English what he writes. What is this siknon? What's going on over here? He says he should know. Ha'adam hu atzmo. A man can only be himself. Hainu ha'pnimiyut. A man is only what is essential within him. That's what he is. Not his body, but his soul, his personality, his ishiyut. Ubechol tenuah tenuah neged ha'pnimiyut. And whenever a person tries to go against his essence, against what he really is, ubepraktishin yogea lechitzuniyut, and the moment that he does that specifically, when he wants to make externally an impression, which in fact he does not represent, hu inyan istalkut ha'adam me'atzmo. At that moment, a man becomes a foreigner to himself. He becomes artificial. You're no longer yourself. V'yotzei lachutz, and he will go outwards, and he will lose himself. Ki yachol hu lelech chutz la'atzmo ad she'en shi'ur. Because man is able to fool himself totally and create out of himself a complete artificial picture, thinking that that is him, and in fact having done something by running away from himself and not at all being anymore who he originally was. And now I come back to the word authenticity. He loses all his authenticity at that moment. He becomes totally inauthentic. Achiyadeh kol atzmo, till he loses himself totally. We should take belima kom belima tzav, and he will lose himself in every sense of the word. He's gone. He still lives. He still does his things. But you know who he is? He's an artificial person. He comes together to the situation of a Navi Sheker. And that can happen to every human being if a human being does not make up his mind and does not want to see himself or herself for whom they are. And once you start to fall into this, says Rabbi Yerucham Meir, you're lost. Because then you become somebody who does not even exist then. And I give you a marvelous example of this. Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu, very interestingly, and not too many people write about this, was a man with a tremendous identity problem. And I tell you why, you also know. Because where was he brought up? Where did he get educated? As a baby, he is brought to the palace of Pharaoh. There he's brought up. That's the education which he gets. Moshe Rabbeinu gets a completely secular, anti-Jewish education. You ever thought about this? Jewish man finding himself in a completely non-Jewish surrounding. And how interestingly enough, this man is becoming the greatest Jewish leader in history. But he started on the wrong foot. We would have thought that Moshe Rabbeinu should have had a kind of Jewish education from the first moment in a good religious environment, Jewish environment. No, he's brought up in a completely different world. And when he grows up, says the Torah, what do you read? You all know the Pesukim. But let's have a look into these Pesukim very carefully. It says, Vayihi bayamim ha'hein, vayigdal Moshe vayetze elachav. And Moshe grows up, and he's already grown a person, and then for the first time, he hears about these people sitting on, living on the other side of the border lines. There's a Jewish people living there. He doesn't know who they are. But it says, Vayigdal Moshe, he somehow grows up, Vayetze il Echav, and he goes out to his brothers. He knows these people over there, they are my brothers. There's something about them. I don't know what it is, I don't know how it works, but something in my neshama tells me I've got something to do with these foreigners over there, this group which came with Yaakov Avinu a long time ago. Moshe Rabbeinu doesn't know more than that. And he goes out. Very interesting. You go out. Why do you want to go there? You are an Egyptian. No, no. Something is telling me that I have something to do with this. Says the Torah like this. Hear this. Vayar besiflotam. He goes out. And he sees their suffering and their burdens. Vayar ish mitzri makei ish ivri me'echav. And he sees, Moshe sees, that a Egyptian hits a Hebrew. Hits a Jew. He sees anti-Semitism for the first time in his life. A Jew gets hit by an anti-Semitic person. Now hear this. What has happened then? Vayifen ko vacho. And Moshe looked left and he looked right. He looked around. Vayar ki einish. And he saw there was nobody around. There was no man there. Vayach ikamitzri. And he hit the Mitzri, as you all know. He hit the Egyptian. He just hit the other Jew. And he killed him. And he buries him in the sand. Kills him. This anti-Semitic person. I tell you what I once heard. A marvelous pshat in this. It's not a pshat. It's a marvelous insight. What does this mean? He looked ko vacho. He looked left and right. And he saw there was nobody around. There was no ish. There was nobody around. And therefore, at that moment, he kills the Mitzri. So I heard somewhere in somebody's name, and I don't know who it is. It's not mine. He said like this. What it means is the following. The deeper meaning of this pasuk, and I hope you will never forget this, is the following. Moshe Rabbeinu is coming to the Jews for the first time in his life. That creates an identity problem. Authenticity. Why? Because once you walk into the Jewish people, you have to ask yourself one question. Who am I? Am I an Egyptian? I've been brought up in the palace of Egypt, of Pharaoh, and I always thought I was an Egyptian. Now something is telling me that I'm Jewish. So Moshe Rabbeinu is standing at the borderline over here. He's not sure anymore who I am. Am I Jewish or am I Egyptian? That's the most terrible thing, because you fall in nowhere land. And now he has to make up his mind. At least the first schlag, the first move he has to make to understand that after all, really is Jewish. Says the Torah like this. Vayifen ko vacho. And he looked left and right. Doesn't mean to say that he moved like this and like this. But he used, or he vayar, or vayifen means to say, ko vacho means to say, he looked one way, from where he came, Egypt, Egyptian culture. The Chol, and he looked the other side, the Jewish world. And if you look both ways at the same time, you know what? Vayar ki ein ish. He saw that he himself was not a man. You can't be an ish if you don't know where you belong. Egyptian, one day, a Jew the next day. That's no identity. That's lack of authenticity. So what does he do? Vayifen ko vacho. He looks left and right to both his worlds, and he doesn't know where he belongs. One foot there and one foot there. Vayarki einish, and he sees that therefore he's not a man. And what does he do? Vayach it hamitsu. And he kills the Egyptian in himself.
He doesn't kill the Egyptian out there. He makes an end to his Egyptian identity. I have to make up my mind. And I will bury it in the sand. I have to know where I stand in this world, otherwise I'm not able to continue at all. No man can live like that. And at that moment when he does that, that's the first moment that he moves into the Jewish people. Vayera, and he looked this way and that way, and he saw that himself was not a man, and he kills the Egyptian. He has decided in favor of being Jewish. Authenticity. Now, obviously, he was not straight away there, because it takes a long time before you really get yourself totally into this. You can't make this achlatana moment and say, that's it. You have to work on it. And I'll show you how interesting. A little later, Moshe Rabbeinu comes to the burning bush. Comes Hashem to him and says, I want you to go to Pharaoh, take my people out. Let my people go. So what does Moshe Rabbeinu say back? How interesting. Listen to this. He says to Hashem, Mi anochi, who am I? Ki elegel Pharaoh, that I shall go to Pharaoh. V'chi otzi et b'nei Yisrael min Yisrael, and I shall take the b'nei Yisrael out of Yisrael. What does he mean by that? Who am I? So I think that the deeper meaning, and I've seen this in Hasidic, Sefarim actually stated, that it means the following. Moshe Rabbeinu, you remember, it says to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, I'm not a man of words. I have an impediment. I can't speak. You ever thought about this? Moshe Rabbeinu can't speak, and he keeps repeating this over and over again. On the end, HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives in to him and says, okay, you know who should speak? Aaron. I once looked into the question, how many times did Aaron really speak? I'll tell you how many times. Once. For the rest, Moshe Rabbeinu spoke. If Moshe Rabbeinu said that he had an impediment of speaking, then I wonder about the whole Sefer Devarim, which is one long speech which he gave before he died. The man spoke fantastically. So what are you saying? You're not going able to speak? Yeah, there's a psychological meaning to this. He comes to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, he says, Hashem, you want me to take the Jews out of Egypt? Mi anochi, I don't not yet know enough who am I. And if I don't know yet fully who I am, so how can I take these people out? If my authenticity is not the way as it should be, how can you ask me to do the job? A man can only fight for something if he really stands totally behind it. But I'm not there yet. I've made my first hachlata in the form of deciding in favor of being Jewish, but that doesn't mean to say that I fully understand yet what it implies. So I'm asking you one question. Mi anochi? Who am I? I don't have enough I yet within myself to go out and to save the Jewish people. And then you remember what continues? Moshe Rabbeinu turns around the debate. And he says to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, tell me something else. Who are you? I don't know yet who I am. At least not fully. But who are you? And you know the famous answer is HaKadosh Baruch Hu. HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives straight away the answer. And he says to him, Eye Asher Eye. I am whoever I am. Or if you want, I will be whoever I will be. Hashem gives, without going into all the details here, one answer. I know exactly who I am. And that's the reason why I will be able to get Pharaoh on his feet, on his knees. I will get him to go because I have no identity problem. If anybody's got authenticity, it is HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself. And Moshe Rabbeinu has to learn this. Hashem says to him, okay, you are not there yet. You can't yet say, Eye Asher Eye, I am whoever I am. You haven't learned that yet? Okay, in the meantime, I think Aaron knows more about this. I will have to Aaron to have him speak. But I have you to make sure you better work on yourself till you are able to say yourself, Eye Asher Eye. I will be whoever I am, or I am whoever I am. And only after you see, I have no time to go into this now, in Chumash, that slowly but surely Moshe understands that, then he takes over the job of Aaron. He starts to speak because he loses his speech impediment. Nothing to do with that there's some problem to speaking. It is you can't speak if you don't know who you are. That's the Jewish problem. I would say today, without going into details once more, that this is our biggest problem today in our Jewish world. By the way, also in this country, we have lost our identity. or we are losing it, and we don't know anymore where we are, we confused ourselves. What is said about Vaya Mitzrayim, the HaKadosh Baruch who confused the Mitzrayim, it nearly happens to us today. One person says it means this, another person says it means that, everybody is confused, and because, by the way, because of that reason, without going to any Israeli politics, that's the reason why the world makes fun out of us. Because the world looks to us and says to us, you know, these Jews don't know anymore what they were, what they are. One says like this, another one says like that. They're confused people. The moment you're confused, you can't fight your enemies. The reason why today the Arab world is able to do what it does to us is purely for one reason. Since we don't know anymore who we are, we become an object of playing around with us in every particular way, because every nation which loses its identity is a weak nation. I'll show you an interesting thing. And with that I will stop. We'll finish. You know what is interesting sometimes? Sometimes a non-Jew will remind us of who we really are. There also, Baruch Hashem, in this world, non-Jews are great people and are on our side. I'll give you two or three quotations of non-Jews who wrote about us, and I want you in your mind for a moment to compare that with what I just read you at the beginning when I spoke about this Israeli boy who said to be Jewish is an hereditary disease, it's a machala. I don't know if you ever heard about a very famous Russian writer and author by the name of Leo Tolstoy. Very famous writer. Big lover of the Jewish people. There's a book of his, booklet of his, where he writes the following words about this. Translated straight from Russian. Hear this. This is a non-Jew writing. The Jew is that sacred being who has brought down to this world the everlasting fire and has enlightened with it the entire world. He, the Jew, is the religious source, spring, and foundation out of which all the rest of the people, we the Gentiles, have drawn our beliefs, our morality, and our religion. That's what the non-Jew writes. We are, just to repeat, to make clear that we understand what he's saying, we are sacred beings which brought this world a law of life in the form of religion and morality, and by that we have inspired everybody else. That's the way how this non-Jew sees us. Just compare this to what we just heard from badly enough this Israeli boy. Give you another example. I have a very few in front of me over here. Somebody by the name of a writer and journalist some years ago, writing about this in the Times, one of the famous English newspapers, writes like this. His name is William Rees-Mogg. He writes like this. One of the gifts of the Jewish culture to Christianity is that it has taught Christians, hear this, to think like Jews. It's taught the world to think like us, like the Jews. And any modern man who has not learned to think as if he were a Jew can hardly be said that he has learned to think altogether. Hear this thing? A non-Jew is telling us that we have to learn, we as Gentiles have to learn to think the Jewish way, because otherwise we are not properly thinking. The Jews came there and taught us this. You heard about Paul Johnson? Very famous Catholic historian who wrote a marvelous book about the Jews called The History of the Jews. Very popular. He writes over there the following. All the great conceptual discoveries of the intellect seem obvious and inescapable once they have been revealed, but it requires a special genius to formulate them in the first place. Now, afterwards we can say great discoveries, sure, but who were the people who discovered it for the first time? For that you have to have a special genius, he writes. The Jews had that gift. To them we the Gentiles, we owe the idea of equality before the law. The Jews brought to our attention that everybody is equal, both divine and human. Of the sanctity of life, that you have to sanctify life. The dignity of man. And he says like this, many things, great things, and no time to read this all through for you. He writes on the end, without the Jews, it might have been a much emptier world, an emptier place. If the Jews were not being around, what would we have been doing with this world? I'll give you one more, and there I will finish. Some time ago, about a year or 2 years ago, there's a book published by a non-Jew. I very much disagree with much of what that book writes. It's very pro-Jewish. It's called The Gifts of the Jews. It discusses all the gifts that the Jews have given the last few thousand years to the world, to civilization. The man who wrote this is a man by the name of Thomas Cahill. He's an historian. This is the best quotation I ever found. Not such an easy one. He writes the following, I quote. The Jews gave us, the Gentiles, the outside and the inside. The outside and the inside. Our outlook, our means again the non-Jews, our outlook and our inner life. We all got it from the Jews. This, hear this, very beautifully phrased. We can hardly get up in the morning out of our beds. We can hardly get up in the morning or cross the street without us Gentiles being Jewish. We, Gentiles, we dream Jewish dreams and we hope Jewish hopes. Most of our best words, which we use on a daily language, like new, adventure, surprise, unique, person, vocation, time, history, future, freedom, progress, spirit, hope, justice, are the gifts of the Jews. Are the gifts of the Jews. Here's a Gentile living in a totally different world than you and I live from. And he looks into us, and he looks into our history, our traditions. And he says, you know what? The Jews gave it all to us. They have been creating the great value system, what we today in the Western world make use of. True, the anti-Semitic world does not want to hear about it. But that's the truth. And I again remind you of the statement made by this Israeli boy who says that to him, to be Jewish, means a machala, an inherited kind of machala of illness. We better get back to where we belong. We have to be proud about being Jewish, and that means authenticity. We agree with Sartre about one thing, not about his interpretation of authenticity as far as he is concerned, but what it does mean is you have to make up your mind who you are. We see this from the case of Parashat B'Shalach. We see this in the case of the Gemara about the Navi Sheker. We see this about the case about Moshe Rabbeinu. Am Yisrael today, no doubt, and we as Bachurei Yeshiva, people are religious, we have to send that message to the rest of the Israeli population. We have to say to them, what are you worried about? Just be who you are. Allow, like Moshe Rabbeinu, to get your Jewish neshama back and let it speak to yourself, and you will see that things fall in place, and the non-Jewish world will have much more respect for us. There can't be any respect, any reference to us if we show the world that we don't know anymore whom we are, and we don't want anymore to be whom we are. Once we understand that Chumash, after all, is the one which teaches us very well what we really are and how great our mission is and how important it all is, A, we feel much better, and they will have more respect. I can tell you, many times I've been speaking in universities for non-Jewish crowds. There's always one thing which I learned. If we stand on our principles, being religious, being kosher, doing the things which we need to do, the non-Jewish world has respect for us. The moment we start to give in, and we start to do a little bit here, a little bit there, and they look to us and say, what are they doing with their religion? Then they lose respect for us. We have to make sure that we get that respect back. The best thing indeed is to do that, to invest as much as you can in Jewish education, to be proud. We have a mission in this world. This is not a machala. This is a fantastic, incredible privilege which we have. And if we just keep to what Moshe Rabbeinu did at the beginning of his life, when he became the manhik of the Am Yisrael, by making up his mind clearly for once and for all, by Yivim Kovacho, then things will be much better here in this country, and no doubt outside as well. Let's try, each one of us, in our own way, to make a contribution, and that way we rebuild Am Yisrael, as we always used to. Thank you very much.
Okay. I want to thank Rabbi Cardoza for his powerful, thought-provoking words. There's a sheet going around the room. I don't know if it got to everyone. If it didn't, then make sure that you get